And I can't help but acknowledge the dynamic that, you know, honestly, if this hadn't happened to white women with profile, with visibility of some sort, if this hadn't shattered people's idea of what Hollywood was, if this hadn't shattered people's idea of what happens in congressional halls and offices, then this wouldn't be a conversation that would be happening. And yet, at the same time, this kind of violence, this kind of harassment is incredibly prevalent, particularly in our communities. And so I thought the cover was great. I did think that Tarana should have been on it as somebody who really created the space for this conversation to happen, but who has also been doing organizing on the ground for years. People who I know actually say to me, she saved my life. She allowed me to be seen and to tell me that my experience was not an isolated one and that it wasn't my fault is actually a really important contribution.
We have to leave it there. I thank you so much, everyone, for being with us. We're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us. A very happy birthday to Noam Chomsky.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. The time is 5 o'clock. Up next is the evening news.
Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In on Saturday, December 9th at 6 p.m. at the Global Homestead Garage in Portland. The community rights movements help cities and towns to protect the health, safety, and welfare of their people and natural areas. At the Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In event, the leaders of Community Rights US will speak, as well as Mark Lakem. Again, that's Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In on Saturday, December 9th at 6 p.m. at the Global Homestead Garage, 416 Southeast Oak Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Amid sexual harassment allegations.
A former police officer has been sentenced to 20 years in prison for the murder of an unarmed African-American man.
And a vigil is planned in solidarity with Palestinians.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 7th, 2017. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Senator Al Franken resigned today after a string of allegations of sexual harassment. He denied most wrongdoing in some cases, stating that he remembered it differently or that it hadn't happened at all. Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, who advocated for Franken resigning, stated that, quote, "Sexual harassment or assault, or in any way using your power to demean women, cannot be tolerated," end quote. Franken stated that, quote, "I of all people am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving, while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party." Franken's successor has not yet been announced. Minnesota's Democratic Governor Mark Dayton will make an appointment later. This comes on the coattails of Democratic Senator John Conyers retiring after a slew of sexual harassment and assault accusations coming to surface.
A vigil will be held tomorrow in solidarity with Palestinians who oppose Trump's decision to officially recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. This move is deeply troubling to Palestinians who have long advocated for shared access to the Holy City, which contains sites that are sacred to Jews, Muslims, and Christians. The vigil, which is being organized by Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights, will take place from 5 to 6 p.m. in front of the Federal Building on Southwest 3rd and Madison. More information about the vigil can be found on the group's Facebook page. KABU will air live coverage of the vigil during the evening newscast.
A former North Charleston police officer was sentenced to 20 years in prison today for the murder of an unarmed African-American man. Michael Slager was on duty when he pulled over Walter Scott for a broken taillight. Slager initially claimed self-defense, claiming that Scott had stolen his taser. However, cell phone video recorded by a bystander showed Scott running away, being shot 5 times in the back, and Slager placing a taser on his body. Faden Santana, who filmed the event, was initially too scared to release the video, but was moved by anger after hearing Slager's version of the story. The city of Charleston awarded the Scott family $6.5 million after the death of Walter Scott, but subsequent trial ended in a hung jury and was called a mistrial. Slager later pled guilty to a charge of violating Walter Scott's civil rights in order to avoid another lengthy trial. Judge Norton, who is overseeing the case, concluded that the charge would be murder. He stated that the killing was, quote, reckless, wanton, and inappropriate, end quote.
And now here's a daily newscast from the Public News Service.
The Public News Service daily newscast for Thursday, December the 7th, 2017. I'm Mike Clifford. President Trump makes good on a campaign pledge to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Also on our rundown, Georgia recognized as a national leader in the care of youth in foster care, and some perspective from the Lone Star State on the long road to recovery from Hurricane Harvey. Topping our news in the wake of President Donald Trump's announcement Wednesday that the U.S. would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, we get word from the Jerusalem Post that the U.S. is now asking Israel to temper its response to the move because Washington expects a backlash and is weighing potential threats to U.S. facilities and people. That's according to a State Department document seen by Reuters. In a White House speech announcing the change, Trump said it was the right thing to do. The New York Times reports Palestinians burned photos of Trump in Gaza in response to the move. Folks from Colorado are joining a National Day of Action today, calling on Congress to block the FCC's plans to overturn Obama-era rules that treat the Internet like a utility.
Caroline Fry with Colorado Common Cause says net neutrality rules prevent Internet service providers such as Comcast or Verizon from blocking or slowing down consumer access to websites and ensure that all online content is treated the same.
If I go and try to access my friend's website where she sells custom-made sweaters, I should be able to access her website in the same way that I'm able to go online to Amazon and buy a new toaster.
FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, a former lawyer for Verizon, claims regulating the Internet as a utility has slowed investment in broadband networks. In Denver, supporters of net neutrality are set to gather at Colorado U.S. Senator Cory Gardner's office today and at Skyline Park on Saturday. Events are also planned in Boulder, Colorado Springs, Durango, Estes Park, Fort Collins, Pueblo, Salida, Trinidad, and Westminster. I'm Eric Galatas.
Nearly 4 million people submitted comments in favor of net neutrality, and according to a recent survey, almost 80% of Americans want the rules kept in place. Meantime, Andrea Sears tells us community organizers say they have twice the number of signatures they need to put paid family leave and a $15 minimum wage on next year's ballot in Massachusetts.
The grassroots effort gathered almost 275,000 signatures from 346 of the 351 towns and cities in Massachusetts. Andrew Farnitano with Raise Up Massachusetts, the coalition supporting the effort, says the numbers show that past successes in raising wages for workers have benefited everyone in the state.
I think people in Massachusetts realize that, and they realize that these are common sense things we can do to help working people and strengthen our economy.
If the state legislature doesn't act on the issues by the end of July, the coalition will need to collect about 11,000 more signatures to secure their place on the ballot in November.
Andrea tells us increasing the minimum wage would raise the pay of almost a million Massachusetts workers. And the state of Georgia leading the way when it comes to making sure that preteens and teens in the state's foster care system are equipped with the tools to succeed in life. The Multi-Agency Alliance for Children was highlighted in a recent N.E. Casey Foundation report. Victoria Salzman, Program Director for Georgia Youth Opportunities Initiative at the Alliance, says the report underscores the practices already in place in the Peach State.
The things that we've been doing or know that we should do or it's best practice, and this really gives us the reasoning behind it. If we look at it from a more macro or community level, there's a lot of impact on our general population and our community.
The Casey Report emphasizes best practices such as training staff and foster parents on the role of trauma and racism and addressing the social stigmas that often come with being a child in foster care. More than 9 out of 10 Ohioans between 18 and 64 have health insurance. Suzanne Potter reports just over half get it from their employer.
Researchers at the private foundation focused on improving health have tracked where people get their insurance since 2006 and found that the rate of uninsured people is stabilizing. Kate Keller with Interact for Health says the state has made major progress.
So we're down to about 10%, which is about half of where we were prior to the ACA due to the expansion of Medicaid in Ohio, where we have about 750,000 people who now have insurance that didn't have it before prior to the Affordable Care Act passing.
Ohio fares slightly better than the nation as a whole, where 12% of adults 18 to 64 are uninsured.
And finally, word from Mark Richardson that 3 months after Hurricane Harvey hit southeast Texas, nearly half of the residents affected by the storm say they are not receiving the help they need to recover.
A joint survey by the Episcopal Health Foundation and the Kaiser Family Foundation finds that Black and Hispanic families were hit harder than others and report a much higher percentage of losses due to property damage and lost income. Elena Marks, president of the Episcopal Health Foundation, says they did the survey to find out where recovery funds might do the most good.
Philanthropy has been very, very generous, and hundreds of millions of dollars have been raised. We wondered how those people would know what to do with that money and how the agencies they might distribute it to would know who needed what kind of help.
The report also found that the storm has taken a toll on people's mental and physical health, with 6 out of 10 storm victims reporting they've skipped or postponed a doctor's appointment or had difficulty obtaining mental health care. That's our news for now. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Communities near the fishing industry of Bristol Bay are larger and often have more seasonal and year-round work opportunities than those inland near the proposed Pebble Mine site in Alaska. Some residents are eager to take jobs related to the project, while others oppose the project, citing environmental concerns. In our series, Alaska Water Wars, Daisha Eaton reports on a man camp built this summer to house people working to develop the mine.
Clinton Hobson plugs exploration drill holes that are leaking water at the Pebble Mine site, where it's rolling tundra, streams, and lakes as far as the eye can see.
It's hard work, but hey, it's a job.
Hobson is Athabascan. He lives about 50 miles across Lake Iliamna from the mine site in the tiny village of Kakanak, where jobs are scarce. He says he's happy to have the work.
I got bills to pay.
He makes almost $20 per hour in the seasonal job. Outside Kakanak, Brad Anguson, who works for the Alaska Peninsula Corporation, shows off a project.
This is the Kakanak Man Camp. There's approximately about 12 to 15 tents here.
Anguson is Sukpiak, a Lutik Alaska native. His mother's family is from Kakanak, a community of about 170 Yupik, Sukpiak, and Athabaskan Alaska Native people. The unemployment rate fluctuates from a low of around 9% in summer to a high of 16% in midwinter. And even if they don't want to work directly for the mining company, many residents are desperate for jobs to help them stay in their villages. The village corporation that Anguson works for represents Kakanak and four other villages. Some of those villages, he says, are on the verge of disappearing.
Alaska Peninsula Corporation has villages that are what I consider to be nearing the brink of abandonment.
The camp employed 15 residents this summer. 27-year-old Nicholas Mike, who is Yupik, is one of them. He makes $20 per hour, and the money is critical.
Well, it means a lot. I get to stay home, close to family. I don't have to deal with traffic in Anchorage.
He does see one drawback, though.
I haven't been able to really do any subsistence this summer.
Anguson says he knows that developing the mine is a risk to the area's pristine waters, but he hopes it can be done safely and dramatically change the economic outlook for the region. I'm Daisha Eaton.
A group of Eastern Washington tribes is joining a nationwide movement to reclaim indigenous identities and retell Native stories. In this case, it's about a name change, as correspondent Emily Schwing reports.
Andrew Colville was a Scottish businessman, best known for governing the Hudson Bay Company. Fort Colville was named for him. It was flooded during construction of the Grand Coulee Dam. His name was given to 12 bands that make up the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation.
When you think about a white man that's never set foot on the reservation, there really is no connection there.
Megan Francis is the public affairs officer for the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation. This summer, the tribal council floated the idea to drop Colville from their name.
And so with this whole modern movement of identity, we really want our future generations to have that connection.
In the next few weeks, the Colville Tribal Council will send ballots to nearly 9,500 tribal members across the region with one question: should they change the name or not? Ballots will be counted by February. If the referendum is approved, the name-changing process will begin this spring. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
Funeral services are planned for Monday in Loup, Arizona for Navajo co-talker George Willie Sr. Willie is being remembered for his service in World War II. His family says he was a kind father and grandfather. They say he developed dementia in his older years, which took a toll on his health. The 92-year-old passed away earlier this week after being released from the hospital for hospice care. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on gentrification. It's the second part of a special called Making Contact. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, a Native youth news and public affairs show featuring local and national Native issues and contemporary Native music. That's followed at 7 by Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Then at 8, tune in for Ear to the Streets of Portland, conversations around organizing in the Black African community in Portland and surrounding areas in Oregon, and music of all genres in free form. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy with a low of 33. Tomorrow, expect partial sun to make the high of 46 feel less like a low. Today is Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, and Governor Brown ordered flags to be flown at half-mast in memory of the American service members who died there in 1941. We might also take time today to remember the more than 100,000 people who were forced into internment camps a year later as the U.S. government sought to clear the west coast of Japanese Americans. Fred Korematsu, an Oakland native who was arrested for resisting internment, took his case all the way to the Supreme Court. The court upheld his conviction and sent him to the Central Utah War Relocation Center until the war ended. Korematsu's conviction was overruled in 1983 when it was revealed that the U.S. government knew that Japanese Americans posed no threat to national security. The quote of the day is from Marilyn Pate, the federal judge who overturned Korematsu's conviction. Quote, Korematsu stands as a constant caution that in times of war or declared military necessity, our institutions must be vigilant in protecting constitutional guarantees.
And now it's time for the ninth installment of Sex for Sale, KBOO's news series on the business of sex in Portland. This episode examines the art and business of stripping. Tom and Natalie talk with local burlesque performer Honey LaFleur and stripper Fauna in order to understand this important corner of the business of sex.
The internet has changed everything, but the one part of the sex trade in Portland that is most consistent is stripping. This is the ninth in KBOO's 10-episode series on the business of sex in Portland. In this episode, we tackle the subject of getting naked. How about those strip clubs that are so conspicuous as you drive across town? How do they fit in the industry picture here?
There are two different kinds of things happening here. One is burlesque, which seems to have evolved, at least here in Portland, into performance art. Here's Honey LaFleur talking about that.
And I do think that it's, I know plenty of women that make a career out of it, if not forever, for at least a time. You know, it's just like any other, I think, body-based artistic form. Because I do think there's an art to stripping as well. And it's just, I think it just looks different. And I think that people look down on it because we're taught to not respect bodies and to cover them up. I mean, it sounds so cliche to say it like that, but there's a lot of power in just like showing your bod and getting somebody's like full on paycheck or something. Like, it's like just giving you money. I think it's actually quite a feminist act to do that because, again, it's about a woman's body taking up space in the world. And also the other thing about it, too, is like strippers make money. Like there's a lot of money to be had to play into and against patriarchy and those like patriarchal and heteronormative views that people have of a body on stage.
But the real story is about stripping, dancing in clubs that cater to, well, horny guys. In the sex industry, stripping seems to be one of the slippery slopes between what's legal and what's not. And strip clubs occupy that gray zone. Here's Red Reed on the connection between stripping and prostitution.
I think that when women are kind of put in a corner where they're not making money dancing, some women choose to do prostitution as a means to an end. Like, you have to make money somehow, and a place like Portland doesn't provide that. So some women choose to do prostitution or full service.
Yeah. It's just another way to make your rent.
Yeah.
And here's Agent Bean of the FBI on stripping as a stepping stone into prostitution.
The strip clubs can be kind of a gateway for that type of activity, to allow someone to kind of let their guard down. I mean, we traffic are developing a victim and what that looks like. And part of that is kind of breaking down your natural defenses of, you know, I don't want to have sex with a stranger. I think there's some characteristics about Portland specifically that do enable traffickers to ply their trade with much success here. And you see that in strip clubs and adult sex shops, et cetera. I don't think the adult sex shops are so much of a causality as I do think the strip clubs are, because, you know, one of the things that we know about sex trafficking is the normalization of sexual exploitation tends to increase its proliferation. So if the community accepts sexual exploitation as the norm, then that's a area where you may find an increased occurrence of sex trafficking.
Wait a minute. Did you say we accept exploitation as a norm?
If a community does, it's the community factors. I didn't say that we did, but I said if a community accepts sexual exploitation as kind of a norm, and it depends on what your beliefs are with respect to strip clubs, right? You know, we
right.
have strip clubs that allow an 18-year-old to dance in front of adults. And an 18-year-old is an adult. But, you know, at what point does the normalization of that sexual activity, being dancing naked, at what point does that maybe turn the corner to something that's more participatory?
Our research for this series took us to Diablo 2, a club on McCullough. It's a big open room with a bar to your right as you walk in and a stage area with two poles taking up most of the rest of the stark, undecorated space to your left. Customers, mostly 20-something guys when we were there, sat around a bar that creates a rectangle around the two dance poles. On those poles and on the bar itself, women stripped and danced. The dancer worked around the bar and got close to each customer, who paid out $2 bills as the dancers got even closer. What's it like to work as a stripper in Portland? Here's what Fauna had to say about that.
Life stripping in Portland is definitely different than other cities because the strip clubs here don't allow for most women to make more than just enough to live by.
How do they limit what you make? I mean,
You don't, first of all, get paid. When you're working there, you pay the strip club to work there via a stage fee. And after tipping out, everything you keep is just from the tips that people give you and the dances you make. But the strip clubs here in Portland, first of all, there's so many of them because it's so easy to open them in Portland compared to other cities because it's easier to get a liquor license.
I've heard that there's like 100. Is that possible?
I don't think there's quite a... 45? Yeah, it's less than that. But
get the magazine and count. I counted one time, but this was years ago, so it was like 45 back then.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not quite 100. It's because of the strip clubs and the owners. To them, they want as many people in the strip clubs buying cheap mm-hmm. drinks as possible. Yeah. So they don't charge a door fee, whereas other cities do. The drinks are really cheap, where other cities charge a lot for drinks, kind of weeding out people that aren't going to spend money. So the environment for the strippers in Portland is just dancing for free for people drinking, and you're not making hardly anything. You have to really try hard to make money. You have to like talk to every customer. You have to try harder than other cities mm-hmm. to make money. And I know this because I've traveled other cities in the U.S. and it's 100 times easier, even when it's not full nude, which Portland is. And the contact level here is higher than a lot of places. Yeah. So guys kind of feel more entitled to your body. They, they're just really like, what am I going to get for $20? And you're going to get a dance, but they're expecting some like level of contact where other cities don't really have that. They're stricter.
That was new to me. I was at a club the other day and I saw that. What can you do if somebody goes beyond? Is there some limit to what they can do? I mean,
there is, but strip clubs don't really like protect you. I've done dances where guys have pulled out their genitals mm-hmm. and I've almost sat on it and told a bouncer and they don't call the cops. They don't do anything. They just sometimes kick them out for crossing your boundaries.
So you're really on your own.
Yes.
Yeah.
Especially in a place like Portland.
And stripping here is racist?
Do you think that out of all the clubs that I've danced at, Portland is definitely the most racist city? A lot of clubs tend to not hire women of color, and if you are a woman of color, you have to be racially ambiguous to get like the decent shifts, the night shifts. And it's I've worked at clubs where when I started in Portland, where I remember there was these two African American women that walked in and auditioned, and this is a club that prides themselves on being progressive and feminist. These two women auditioned, and after they left, the bartender and the bouncer were joking about how they thought all black women could dance and how they weren't going to get hired. And they were just very openly racist and It's just I've seen the least diversity in Portland for that. So women of color that wish to dance that don't get hired, which happens a lot, have to end up doing other forms of sex work to survive.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
So racist here.
Yeah, it's very racist.
Here we can tell the rest of the Bowley story. Club dancers have rights under state law, but how much enforcement is there really?
Was your work with Bowley, did you feel it was successful?
No.
Why? Why not?
They had absolutely no investment in maintaining the live entertainer hotline. They used me as a receptionist, and once I quit, which was 3 months into the job because I was disappointed at how it was going, they never replaced me. I know people who've called the hotline and have never gotten a call back. As far as I know, that $69,000 that went into that position has just gone elsewhere.
There are several other types of stripped-down attractions in Portland, like the bikini drive-through coffee shops, the naked bike race, Humpfest, and the undressed laundromat, but we'll let you research them for yourself. Okay, we're just kidding. About the laundromat, anyway.
Stripping is big business in Portland. We've heard the different perspectives of the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industry and Red Reed of Stroll. What do you think? Are we treating this business in a way that's fair and sensible?
We'd like your feedback. At the end of this series, we'd like to do a follow-up episode in which you get to speak your mind on this subject. If you have a comment or question about the series or about the sex trade, we'd like to hear it. Call the KBOO Newsroom at 503-231-8032, extension 202, and we'll hear you out and put you on the air.
I'm Tom.
And I'm Natalie.
And that's it for episode 9 of Sex for Sale. It's 5:30 and time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
The Trump tax plan is not selling well. Indeed, 2/3 of the American people oppose it, and only 16% believe it would reduce their tax bill. But wait, say Trump and his congressional trumpeteers, we're really trying to help you commoners. How? By killing the death tax. So when you die, your estate can go to your heirs without that inheritance being taxed. As the president so eloquently put it, to protect millions of small businesses and the American farmer, we are finally ending the crushing, the horrible, the unfair estate tax. Hooray! Donald is saving us! Actually, no. The great majority of Americans don't own farms, businesses, or big estates of any kind. So that tax doesn't even apply to us. Also, 99% of the people who do have farms and businesses are already exempt from the tax, since it only applies to estates worth $5.5 million or more. I realize that Trump prefers grandiose claims over actual facts, but here are a few reality checks showing that his statement is not just a lie, it's a whopper. This year, a mere 0.2% of American families will inherit enough money to owe any estate tax. That's only about 11,000 families, not millions, as Trump so theatrically proclaimed. As for protecting our nation's family farm and small business estates from taxation, only 80 of those are big enough to be subject to the tax this year. So who exactly is Trump saving from having to pay some taxes on their multimillion dollar estates? The richest 0.2% of American families, including one named Trump. This is Jim Hightower saying, killing the estate tax lets a handful of elites, the richest of the richest, escape from paying more than $20 million each. And that's what the Trump plan really is all about.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now it's Labor History in 2 with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1907. That was the day that troops from the 22nd Infantry arrived in Goldfield, Nevada, on the orders from President Teddy Roosevelt. 1,900 gold miners organized by the Western Federation of Miners were on strike. They walked out in late November when cash-strapped mine operators began paying them in scrip. Local 77 held considerable power in the mines and the town for 2 years. They had won the 8-hour day both for their members and established it as an industrial standard throughout Goldfield. By 1907, the mine operators and Nevada Governor John T. Sparks had had enough. Wobblies were on trial elsewhere, falsely accused of murdering Idaho Governor Frank Stoutenberg for his role in the 1899 miner strike in Coeur d'Alene. Many miners in Goldfield had been active in that strike. Sparks feared that with no force capable of protecting the operators, another mine war was inevitable. The mine owners convinced Sparks that the miners were heavily armed and capable of dynamiting mine property. At the same time, the operators tried to provoke local 77 miners to engage in illegal activities for which they could be arrested. They also used the financial panic of 1907 to pay workers in scrip and as a pretext to smash the union, even though the gold standard remained relatively stable. The owners then made their moves. They reduced wages and threatened workers with mass firings and strike breakers. But the union remained disciplined and peaceful during the strike. It was clear by the following March that the presence of federal troops gave the mine owners the impetus they needed to drive local 77 miners out of the mines and out of Goldfield.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Life may be stressful, but you don't have to run and hide. Just sit back and enjoy the sounds from the bottom of a water-filled stone well next to an abandoned mansion in Winchester, Kentucky.
Now it's time for the Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen, 6 minutes of nationally syndicated independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It's Thursday, December 7, 2017.
Raging wildfire continues to burn in the heart of Los Angeles.
Southern California wildfires continue to rage out of control. Interior Secretary proposes shrinking even more national monuments. New study warns even more public lands at risk due to fossil fuel exploitation. Plus, good news for renewable energy. It's now cheaper than both coal and nuclear plants.
All of that good and not so good news straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Trump signed an order slashing the size of bear's ears and Grand Staircase National Monuments. Yes, I can understand. Oh, hey, come on. It's reasonable that he doesn't care about them. They're just national monuments. They're not Confederate monuments.
Oh, man. This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, as you reported in our previous Green News Report, the Navajo Nation and other American Indian tribes are suing the Trump administration over slashing the size of those national monuments, and now Outdoor recreation company Patagonia has announced that they, too, will sue, calling his reduction of the size of bears' ears by 85% an extreme overreach in authority. The company also put a full-page banner on the front of their website, "The President Stole Your Land," and Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke says that that advertisement was shameful.
Well, it looks like it's a very unpopular move that Trump has made, and more on that in just a minute. First off, though, California's most destructive fire season on record has just gotten worse, just weeks after deadly wildfires in wine country in Northern California. Down here in Southern California, multiple wind-driven wildfires exploded across the region this week. As we go to air, four major active fires are seriously straining the region's emergency resources. In total, the fires have destroyed more than 300 structures, forced the evacuations of nearly 200,000 people, shut down hundreds of schools and major freeway arteries, and enveloped the Los Angeles region in smoke. Thankfully, no deaths or major injuries have been reported. The largest and most destructive fire has hit the historic beach city of Ventura, California, burning 80 square miles, covering a football field every few seconds. In a press conference on Wednesday, Los Angeles County Fire Chief Daryl Osby told residents in woodland areas to be prepared to leave at a moment's notice.
It's critically important if there's an incident in your area that you evacuate early. We're expecting wind gusts in some areas up to 80 miles per hour. If you see something, don't wait for the evacuation order. Leave.
No official word yet on the causes of any of these fires. A multi-day Santa Ana wind event, the worst of the year, has created what the National Weather Service called, quote, a recipe for explosive fire growth.
The state of California uses a color-coded wind map, and the most extreme wind is purple. They have never used that before. They are using that today.
The region has had no meaningful precipitation since March. Because of global warming, California's winters are increasingly warmer and drier, and winter wildfires are increasing in frequency. Now fire season extends all year round. Meanwhile, in the wake of President Trump's slashing the size of two iconic national monuments to allow mining and drilling, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke has now released a draft proposal for shrinking even more of America's protected national monuments, focusing on Cascade Siskiyou in Oregon and Gold Butte in Nevada. Zinke also proposed management changes for six more. That's code for allowing drilling, logging, and mining.
I can think of somewhere else I'd like to see some management changes.
In a statement, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon noted that national monuments generate millions in tourism for local economies, saying, quote, Donald Trump's rollback harms rural economic progress and job creation. And also, very disturbingly, Zinke proposes opening up vast marine ocean reserves to industrial-scale commercial fishing, areas specifically set aside to rebuild depleted fisheries, crucial for sustaining the nation's seafood supply. And now a new report this week calculates just how much of the American public's land may be at risk of destruction from the Trump administration because they sit atop fossil fuels. In a first-ever comprehensive analysis, Greenpeace found that more than 120 million acres of federally protected lands larger than the state of California contain or overlap fossil fuel reserves and could be next on the chopping block as Trump reshapes American land policy to benefit the fossil fuel industry. Finally, though, some good news for renewable energy. A new study finds the cost of new wind and solar projects is cheaper now than running existing coal and nuclear plants for electricity. The researchers project that as utility-scale battery storage comes online, renewables will outpace natural gas as well.
Of course they will, as those folks who give a damn have been saying for many years. For much more on all of these reports and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Well, this land's made.
You're listening. You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jasmine Moneymaker and Grace Ann Smith. The producer is Jasmine Moneymaker. Our engineer is Ben Sherigy. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Positively Revolting with Ani and Len taking your calls. At 9, Beloved Communities' John Shuck talks live with Les Jamison about the NSA, Edward Snowden, spying, and the FISA. At 10, on Valley Views, discusses 10 encounters when walking while black. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Digital Divide talks with Ellen Ullman, author of the new book, Life in Code, A Personal History of Technology. KABU is your independent source for news and entertainment. Become a member. Just go to kboo.fm and click donate.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On tonight's News In Depth, we hear the second half of a Making Contact special on gentrification. Two neighborhoods goes to Boyle Heights in Los Angeles and Crown Heights, Brooklyn, New York. Both neighborhoods are experiencing the gamut of changes associated with gentrification, and some are pushing back against those who would cash in on the eviction and displacement of longtime residents. On Tuesday, we aired the segment on Crown Heights, where a restaurant drew the protest of local residents. Today, Making Contact takes us to Boyle Heights, where a coalition of activists is taking direct action against gentrifying forces in the neighborhood.
You're listening to Making Contact, a tale of two heights. Thanks to the generous support of listeners like you, this show is offered for free to stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. Subscribe to our podcast. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Coming up, we'll hear how a neighborhood on the West Coast is responding to the most recent effects of gentrification. We now go to the neighborhood of Boyle Heights, just east of downtown L.A. Over the past few years, it's become a premium location for landlords and speculators.
First come the artists.
That's Claudia Medina, an attorney with Eviction Defense Network. She's explaining how people in her neighborhood were priced out of their homes in the early 2000s.
That's what happened in Echo Park, the art galleries that opened up where Echo Park Avenue and Morton, I think it's Morton, meet. Those art galleries were symbolic of the rapid gentrification that happened in that neighborhood. So, for example, the art galleries with their openings, right? So you would bring in a lot of people like that time that could afford art or could afford to go to those venues as, you know, a luxury. Even when I would talk to people back then, this feeling of, oh my God, I always thought that Echo Park was so dangerous, and now coming here to the art shows, I realize it's not, I didn't get mugged, where I lived.
My name is Carlos Montes with Centro CSO, Community Service Organization based in Boyle Heights.
In 2015, the first of several commercial art galleries started moving into Boyle Heights.
They were very visible, and they were very white, and they were in your face, and they were near what they call the flats. The flats is a traditional community in Ball Heights where you have the projects, the Pico Gardens project, Aliso Village project, the traditional neighborhoods of Cuatro Flats, Primera Flats, where you have a history of organizing that the mothers have organized for years for peace and for tenants' rights and housing rights. So the thing with the gallery is that they were like very, you know, coming in and setting up these fancy galleries. They were primarily white. They didn't have any connection to the neighborhood. They had no connection to the residents at all. So they were look like outsiders coming in to try to take advantage of the space or the empty warehouses.
So an activist coalition formed and called themselves Defend Boyle Heights.
It's a very new group, maybe 2 years old. And it's really not an organization. It's actually a grouping of several organizations. Now, those groups together have raised the issue of gentrification by targeting the galleries coming into Ball Heights on the west side of Ball Heights near the river.
Defend Ball Heights is a coalition that includes different groups that from different parts of the community, mostly very young people who have joined the fight against gentrification, and the Unión de Vecinos is part of that coalition.
Leonardo Vilchis is co-director of Unión de Vecinos.
We really got very frustrated because of the silence of other nonprofits and other leaders with respect to the gentrification process. And we were seeing the effects that was having on the most poor. I mean, the Unión de Vecinos has always worked with the most poor people in the community. I mean, we work with the homeless, we work with street vendors, we work with people who make less than $25,000 a year, and even less families that are very, very low income. And there is very little going on when it comes to development, quote-unquote development, that impacts and improves the life of this community. So when the Defend Ball Heights comes out and starts resisting the push of the galleries and the arts industry and the arts entrepreneurs into Ball Heights, we decided to join that battle. Over time, we've seen the industrialization around the factories, which open up the space for these galleries. And the galleries are basically now are galleries that are connected to money in New York, in Germany, across the world. And it's mostly money that is going to change the face and the character of the neighborhood, the local neighborhood, which in turn threatens against the public housing. I mean, threatens the public housing again. It threatens the housing of the very low-income families who live in Boyle Heights. And it's a cultural wave, basically, that is trying to reshape, redesign, redefine what Ball Heights is.
Carlos Montes.
One error that I see that it was a major error, they targeted self-help graphics, which has been a 45-year-old grassroots Chicano-based art center. They targeted them erroneously and called for the boycott of the organization, which I thought was a big error. I think they should have focused and the galleries that were coming from the outside to boycott those galleries and get the galleries out.
Boyle Heights is bordered by the LA River to the west, Indiana Street to the east, Mission and Barango to the north, and to the south, just before the LA River cuts through Soto Street. Soto Street Elementary School is where Anglo teachers gave my grandmother an English name because they were unwilling to learn her name in Spanish. But that was Boyle Heights and Los Angeles in the 1930s. At that time, Mexicans and Mexican Americans were not as welcome in the U.S. The Great Depression was on, and in the span of 10 years, so-called Mexican repatriation saw anywhere from 500,000 to 2 million people deported to Mexico. It's estimated that 60% of those who were deported were Mexican Americans born in the U.S. This was also a time when Boyle Heights was more ethnically mixed. Racially restrictive covenants prohibited all kinds of people from buying land or living in homes in other parts of the city. So people of Mexican, Japanese, Russian, Jewish, Italian descent all found themselves living in close proximity to each other east of the LA River and in Boyle Heights.
They moved into houses and the newer large-scale apartment complexes and projects built in the 1930s and 40s. But as whites slowly moved to other parts of the city, and World War II saw Japanese Americans removed to concentration camps, the ethnic makeup of Boyle Heights became a Latino, primarily Mexican neighborhood. It wasn't until the passage of the Fair Housing Act in 1968 that redlining and restrictive covenants were made illegal. Nearly three decades later, the federal government moved to demolish and rebuild public housing. Leonardo Vilchis.
This was a Hope 6 project. It was a plan to demolish 100,000 units of public housing across the country without really replacing any of the housing that was being lost. In the case of Pico Aliso, we lost about two-thirds of the housing. 900 families were displaced out of the community. 900 units were lost. And to this day, that housing hasn't come back. And the people who got their vouchers and certificates are living in communities that are very similar to Boyle Heights in the 1980s, a very desperate community with lots of violence and very lack of services.
The Hope 6 project affected the poorest Americans in cities across the country. California Congresswoman Maxine Waters addressing the House in 2008.
The administration eliminated the one-for-one replacement requirement in 1996, effectively triggering a national sloughing off of our nation's public housing inventory.
For us, for Unión de Vecinos, gentrification started in 1996 with the demolition of the housing projects. A lot of people had promised that this was going to be an improvement in the community. But what we saw is that every time that the city or the government or some corporation was coming and saying, here's an improvement for you, a bunch of families were pushed out. So first we have the demolition of the projects, 900 families lost. Then we have the expansion of the Gold Line, about 200 families that lose their housing. Then you have the expansion of the police department, 65 families. Then you have the expansion of the general hospital. So public investment, about $3 billion of public investment, were pushing people out, supposedly to improve the community. So we started realizing that the poor were the sacrificial lambs of development in Boyle Heights.
The Battle of Chavez Ravine was an infamous episode in the history of forced displacement of people of color in Los Angeles. Chavez Ravine is where Dodger Stadium was built. Using eminent domain, landowners were informed that their land was to be used as the site of a public housing project. After families sold their land, the housing project was canceled, and the remaining families who'd refused to sell were forced to leave. 3 years later, the first pitch was thrown at Dodger Stadium. But it's 2017 and times have changed, right? There are no repatriation efforts in this country. We don't use eminent domain to evict poor people for public works projects that may or may not come to fruition. So how are residents being forced to leave their homes? Eviction defense attorney Claudia Medina.
I feel like these are conversations that happen in real estate circles and landlord circles where they see it as, okay, if you could just get rid of that tenant that's in a rent-controlled unit, you could hike up the rent. So there's a big bullseye on that tenant or those tenants in a particular unit. So a lot of landlords already, they already have this intent of buying up a property that's occupied by long-term rent-controlled tenants, usually low income, and then they start harassment tactics. That's common. Like, they'll do that to the entire building. They'll go in within a few months of buying. They start serving a bunch of notices to quit, and from there, eviction cases. And they bank on these tenants then not getting an attorney. And that's what happens. And this is what landlords rely on.
And some of those tactics from a landlord's perspective might be,
we're intentionally going to make it hard for you to pay your rent, and then we're going to claim that you didn't want to pay your rent. They will pretend they didn't get it, and how we know that they're pretending and they're lying about not getting it is because they're doing it to all the units. So how is it that a bunch of your units mailed their rent to this one address that you provided, landlord, and how is it that you didn't get any of their rents? Since when is the United States Postal Service that unreliable? Or getting tenants to sign documents they don't understand. For example, a tenant lives there with five people, and a landlord comes around and says, sign this document. And the document says, oh, you agree that you're only going to have two people Knowing that that tenant has never had two people, they've always had five people, and now the landlord turns around and says, oh, you're violating your lease.
Medina's been doing this work for 17 years, first as an organizer and then as an attorney. She's seen this kind of harassment up close.
And it starts getting a tenant psychologically, you know, because if here's this landlord with a lot more resources and knowledge of the law continuously harassing you and trying to psych you out. Like, I give the analogy of in sports, to get into your head in some way where they awaken that voice in your head that will instill fear in you. What if they're right? What if I don't take this money? What if I do end up on the street? What if they are going to be able to get me out one way or another? Might as well just take what they're offering me and leave. Right? So that's the kind of harassment that some tenants are dealing with on a daily basis simply because their neighborhood is now trendy. There's so much that could be done in LA to protect tenants. We could pass anti-harassment laws, for example. We could implement a right to counsel program like New York has adopted, where the city's funding right to counsel, meaning that the city will provide funds so that tenants could have more access to representation.
We need a moratorium on rent increases. We need a more aggressive code enforcement process. And long term, we want to start seeing more changes in how property is being transferred here. We cannot wait for all these laws to happen. We cannot wait for all these things to happen. So the fight continues. We have to protest. We have to put pressure. We have to make things happen. This is the way politics works in America and everywhere else in the world. It's not just inside negotiating with the government. It's also about raising your voice. The civil rights movement didn't happen just because people sat down on a table and said, oh, let's change the law.
That wraps up this edition of Making Contact, A Tale of Two Heights. This show was produced by Monica Lopez and RJ Lozada. Music was by Blue Dot Sessions, Lobo Loco, Ryan Little, and Black Ant. Special thanks to this week's contributors who both have their own podcasts, Otis Gray, producer of Hungry, and Jesus Hermosillo, producer of This Is Where We Stay. The Making Contact team is Lisa Redman, Anita Johnson, Marie Che, Monica Lopez, RJ Lozada, Sabine Blazin, and Vera Tykolsker. I'm your host, Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 p.m. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Posada Milagro 2017 on Sunday, December 10th from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Milagro Theater in Portland. The day's festivities include music and folkloric performances.